Spider Pig, does whatever a spider pig does. Can he swing from a web? No, he can't. He's a pig. Look out, he is a spider pig.
Welcome, everybody, to a new edition of the Heck Yeah Comics Podcast.
Heck yeah.
I'm David Luzader, and with me, as always, for the second time,
Nick Shamooksness.
Do you not even know how to pronounce your own name?
I have a funny story to that, but it's not comic book related, so I'm going to make it into a comic book, and then we can talk about it.
Okay, no. You know, while we're at the top of the show here, why don't you tell us a funny story about not being able to pronounce your own name?
So my sixth grade graduation rehearsal, I don't, like, remember. I had to go up a couple times because I won some awards. I know, Prodigy Child, it's gotten me far. and I guess when they called my name, for like me to get my quote unquote sixth grade diploma, my teacher said my name and he said Cher Mooksness. And then we got back to class that day because this was the rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And my teacher, who I actually had a pretty good relationship with, my sixth grade teacher, and he was like really upset, and he was like telling me, like, sit down and, like, you know, stop telling me how to pronounce Nick's last name. And which was kind of odd for me because, like, despite, like, I had a good relationship with him, I was very quiet in the sixth grade.
Yeah.
I didn't want to talk to anyone. So the fact that anyone in my class was, like, making it a point to defend my last name, you know, sixth grade problems. Right. I just thought it was odd that I was even visible to most people. But he was just like, I know how to pronounce Nick's name. I talked to his mother and it's pronounced Cher Mooksness. And for the longest time, like, I think I was close, but I was like, Sir Mooksness or Cher Mooksness, or I was something like, I
had no idea.
And I had no idea. And, like, my, you know, I'm assuming my teacher got it from my mom. It must be true. So I, like, sunk back in my seat and I was like, I'm not a part of this.
Oh,
this isn't on me.
Wow, your competency is putting wonderful faith in this show.
No, people, it's a story like that helps endear people to me and my struggles with everything.
And it makes me seem like the smart one, which is a bonus for me.
We'd be like Pinky and the Brain.
Anyway, makes me the Brain. Everybody likes Pinky better. They just laugh at the Brain. You're a jerk.
People like me better.
Debatable. All right.
Yeah, that's true.
Before we launch into everything, there's some housekeeping stuff that I meant to do last week, but all just the nerves and excitement of a first episode, I kind of forgot. I want to give a big thank you to Victoria, or Vicky, I'm not sure what she goes by, Vicky Verhagen, for doing our artwork, the neat little Daily Planet, Heck Yeah, We Love Comics with the Silver Surfer on there. I also want to thank Boxcat Games, who does the theme song we've been using in. It's called Breaking In. It's a Creative Commons song I found, but I still want to make sure I'm giving credit where credit is due. And one more thing is, why, Nick, are we the Heck Yeah Comics Podcast? I ask that because Heck Yeah is a group on Facebook that Nick started. What's the story there?
Well, I guess the unsavory seedy story of the whole thing is, I mean, I basically was struggling for a name and I wanted to start a Facebook group where the people I associated with and people that I associated with who also associated with like-minded people, you know, could come and post links on things that they found interesting. And, I mean, it just, a lot of good names have been taken, you know, respect to them,
right.
But I just was like, heck yeah, you know, I mean, we love comics. That excites me. Heck yeah. Heck yeah. We love comics. So yeah, I mean, the official Facebook group that we come from is the Heck Yeah, you know, we love comics, you know, but Heck Yeah. Well, I guess we're called Heck Yeah, We Love Comics. It's just more Heck Yeah.
Yeah. It's Heck Yeah Comics. It's easier.
Yeah.
Just quicker.
Yeah. And then when we inevitably publish a smashing memoir of our journey, we can be under our own self-imprint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When all two people buy that book, one for you and me.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny looking.
Actually, We'll probably get free copies, so it won't even...
It'll cost us money to publish this book that we never get back.
We will pay for our book.
It's really funny, like, looking at, like, the numbers for last week, because, you know, nobody knows who we are. So it's like, huh, I know that two of those plays are me and Nick, so that doesn't count. Anyway, on to what we're really here for, which is comic books. Yay!
Wait, this is not a podcast about pumpkin carving?
No, that's next. The thing we're doing after this one.
David, wait, I have an idea for a podcast.
Heck yeah, pumpkins?
Heck yeah, pumpkin carving podcast.
Done. Deal. Cut this. We're done. We're moving on to the next one.
But okay,
while we're here, they
came here to listen to something. So let's tell them about the history of our grandparents. As told through New 52 Futures End.
Yes. I actually didn't get a whole lot this week. Futures End was one of them. I got Batman Eternal and Justice League United. Nothing big going on in those, I feel like. So all the big stuff is going on in Futures End. Which we kind of talked about last week, not briefly at all, actually, for a good chunk of time. This week, I actually, you know, I thought the first issue was a little rocky, but I liked this one a lot more. It's completely under the banner. Should we spoil? I mean, it's kind of on the cover.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so Green Arrow at the end of Futures End number one, Green Arrow was found dead. And then this one takes place primarily at the funeral of Green Arrow, except for the two pages of Batman, which, still great, robotic Alfred. That'll be interesting to see where that's going. We'll talk more about Batman Beyond in a bit. But Futures End, primarily Green Arrow. I thought there were some really great moments. I really enjoyed Animal Man's eulogy, which revealed that Oliver Queen in this continuity was public the whole time. Not the whole time, but like a bit into, so sometime after the Outsiders War, which just wrapped up in Green Arrow number 31 last week. I think it's promising. Because, you know, we're not seeing those big players yet. Like, you see Wonder Woman, but you don't see Batman or Superman. Mm-hmm. Like, it's still like, where are they at? And I really appreciate that it's not just like, we're just going to focus on the big three. But even with, like, when they did the whole 52 event, it really felt like a big chunk of that was like, where's Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman? Because they were missing the whole time. And this one, I mean, they've barely even, like, been thought about. So I really like that we're seeing the world of this new future as a whole. It doesn't seem like there's too much different, but like there's that little seeds of the whole war that happened, which you do find out was the Earth 2 war. And I'm really curious to see where this is going.
I agree, though I have to say, what was going on with Roy Harper's Arsenal costume? He literally looks like the guy from Youngblood. You know, it's very Rob Liefeld. Is it Liefeld?
It's Liefeld. Oh, I mean, wow. I hadn't really looked at it.
I mean, when you look at it, it's like, I think from what I'm seeing so far, despite, like, say, my really excited involvement of, like, Brian Azzarello and Jeff Lemire.
Which Brian Azzarello wrote two pages on this one.
Yeah. I feel like it for a comic that's taking place in the future, and I think this is something that DC's kind of been struggling with across the line, is the books especially because their whole goal was to be modern contemporary. It doesn't feel contemporary modern. It doesn't feel like this is taking place 5 years in the future in so many ways. I mean, the fact that Arsenal's general costume aesthetic is, you know, I don't know, very 90s. And I think that
he has two quivers.
He does.
One is just hanging off on his side there.
Rob Liefeld.
That is awful. He does have a lot of pouches.
I guess that's, to me, that sort of, as far as aesthetics go, I mean, the story can be compelling, but it feels like it's DC's not trying to do what they are advertising to do. Now, like Adam Strange, I'm looking on the same exact page, looks really cool. And even Firestorm, actually has a pretty cool
Yeah,
look.
Firestorm's new costume's pretty neat.
But did you actually notice, if you look on the page when they're carrying the casket at the top of the page, am I looking at the right page?
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Yeah, I see Strange.
Nope, wait, I missed it. I'll find it, but
Animal Man.
there's a panel that shows Black Canary, and she's wearing a cloak that I don't think they really that they're not like trying to zoom in on. Oh, it's on the big spread. You can see it on the big spread where all the heroes are coming in for the funeral.
Yeah,
She's right.
there's a close-up of her crying at some point.
She's right next to Animal Man, and she's wearing Ra's al Ghul's cloak.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
Yeah, that's something.
Let me find Animal Man here. Oh,
And
wait, is that Superboy in that big spread? I didn't even notice that. The guy with the S? That's gotta be Superboy.
the guy about to land,
Yeah.
that it might be Superboy. It's some character that's going to become important later on in the story. It might
Right.
not be Superboy though.
Yeah, what's Superboy doing?
Well, he's dead.
Really?
The clone is dead, and he's been replaced by the person he was cloned from, which is the future son of Clark Kent and Lois Lane.
Interesting. Did
Yeah.
you knew about so pre-52, you knew Superboy was the clone of Superman and Lex Luthor.
Yes, I did.
Were you the one who like explained to me how that like became continuity?
It was Geoff Johns had submitted a fan letter to, I don't remember which comic it was. It may have been a 90s Superboy comic, explaining how to make Superboy more interesting, and they published it, and whoever was editing the book at the time was like, "Yeah, great idea, kid." And
Right,
then Geoff
that'll
Johns,
never happen.
yeah, basically kind of like, "Well, that's nice." And then Geoff Johns, obviously a very, very big name at DC Comics, got involved, relaunched Teen Titans to much success, and within like three issues, revealed that Superboy was the clone of Lex Luthor as well. And I'm cool with that. I didn't really know this that that the old Superboy that well beyond. I was introduced to him along with Geoff Johns' Teen Titans.
Right.
I did go back and read some of his original series, and I guess he was like half Superman, half like the director of Project Cadmus at the time. And
Yeah.
basically, they revealed, Geoff Johns' retcon, or if that's what you want to call it, is, oh, he's
Yeah.
not actually that guy. That was a cover for the real benefactor of Cadmus, which was Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
Which they've thrown all of that out the window with the New 52.
They have. But I just finished the first season of Young Justice today, and that's actually what they go with is the Lex Luthor Superman thing. It's actually I don't know. I thought they actually did pretty interesting with it because they find a clone that is just like pure Kryptonian DNA, but it's just so wild and untamed, like it's just like the pure powerhouse that they can't control it. So they had to cut his DNA with human DNA, and so they use Lex Luthor. And there's some intrigue that goes on there. It's good stuff.
Well, that's how Superboy is formed.
Yes.
That's very nice, indubitably.
And there's also that they reveal that somebody else was a clone that you wouldn't expect. But I can't tell you that because you have to watch it. It's
I'm
revealed.
gonna have, I'll have to I'll have to watch it.
It's revealed in the last episode of the first season, and the second season's not on there, which is utter crap. Because, come on, guys, it's over. Just put it all on there.
It'll get there. It'll get there, my boy. One costume I do like is Adam
Yeah,
Strange's new
they.
costume.
So Justice League United also came out today, and they show how he gets it.
Oh yeah, like I told you, I haven't actually been able to read that issue yet.
Right.
What copy did you pick up? Did you pick up the one that said Justice League United or Justice League Canada?
I got the one that said Justice League United with the Canadian leaf in the D.
I actually picked up the one that said Justice League Canada.
Interesting.
I don't know why. I kind of looked down. I weighed my options. I decided that this really wasn't the most important thing I had to decide today, and
Right.
left with Canada.
So, okay, here's something I don't get. Green Arrow's costume in Justice League United. They go with the costume that he was wearing before Jeff Lemire took over the Green Arrow book. And it's an awful costume. His new costume is so much better.
Isn't his new costume just if somewhat similar to the TV show? It's more down to like simplified.
Yeah, it's like he has the vest, but he doesn't have like the weird long gloves. He has a hood, which, I mean, I'm assuming, yeah, the old one did as well. But I don't know. It just looks so much better, the new one.
Yeah. I've never been a fan of, yeah, like the sort of the arm pads that go way too up high, or the knee, like the boots that go like past your knees, especially like on guys. Like for girls, I guess if like you're a super stripper, maybe. But like, I kind of understand that the idea of it going past your knees is supposed to be kind of like knee pads, mm-hmm. but aesthetically, it's, I see them running and it looks like a distorted Kinex figure.
Right. Oh, he also has goggles, which the goggles are just awful. I like it much better. Just the raccoon mask, the bandit mask looks a lot better.
Are you there?
Yeah, sorry.
Was that me or you?
That's me. So sorry, everyone. My internet occasionally has issues. Hopefully it'll get over it pretty quick here. It didn't happen last time, so I got hopeful that we could get away with it.
We're gonna have to talk to your internet company.
You know, we tried. I'm gonna have to again. It's really annoying.
Oh, I hear you.
All right, what was that?
Oh, that may have been my phone. Sorry, oh, I was going back to. Anyway. So,
I say. But do you have any last thoughts on Future's End?
I say that. Like I'm still interested in seeing where it goes. Like I kind of like these stories that take place a little bit into the future.
Mm-hmm.
How things could change and how they could change further. But like I said, there's something about the aesthetic that feels like something that's supposed to be about the future. There's something that's supposed to be in 2014. You know,
mm-hmm.
feels very 1996.
Right. I feel that the hints of the future are being more sewn in now. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we see those characters in that big shot of everyone arriving at the funeral, and, you know, some of them are like different, and there's that intrigue of like, well, what happened there? And, you know, like they're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So I think they did better of like showing like, hey, you know, I mean, it's 5 years, not everything is going to be drastically different. But I think they're going to start upping the, like showing us what's going on.
Yeah, and I mean, you can only predict, you know, what is 5 years in the future really going to look like. I feel like if we wanted to compare to the world outside our window, I mean, I feel like it's largely going to, as far as structure-wise, is going to look the same. We might have different kinds of cell phones or Google Glass or what have you, as far as like more miniaturized handheld technology is involved. But I mean, come on, Arsenal.
Hey, you know, everybody goes through a weird phase.
But, I mean, Arsenal. Arsenal.
I really liked that John Diggle was one of the pallbearers. Anyway, we're going to move on now to, speaking of John Diggle, tonight was the season finale of Arrow, and I have not got to see it, so Nick showed up. But we did get our first look at The Flash.
And I'm super excited for it.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. The special effects look really good.
Yeah.
Somebody paused at the right time online. They posted it where, like, his trail actually has all these little flashes of lightning.
And... No, that is definitely true. It was exciting. It was fun. Like, they basically hinted at the fact that, you know, the Flash is following in Arrow's footsteps. It was very thematic. They basically showed that Barry is like super excited to be doing what he's doing.
Right. He's a lot more fun loving, which people have kind of been a little harsh on how Oliver Queen has been shown in the show. Where like he's a little more dour, a little more like serious, but I mean, I feel like it fits with the show, and it's nice now that they're gonna have that character who's gonna be the more lighthearted, you know, super fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he's excited to do what he's doing.
I was reading an interview with one of the writers, and they basically said that, like, Barry and Ollie sort of, what's the word, juxtapose? They're really good in the sense that, like, Ollie is really wants to see the best in people, but he's just, his outward persona is very, like you said, dour, morose, stoic. And Barry is this very bubbly, outgoing, positive person, but deep down he's got like this anger and resentment and frustration inside, and this sense of not knowing, like, you know, why his mom was killed. And you know, it's just it's almost like they're dealing with very similar problems in the opposite way.
Yeah, and I really I liked when he was on Arrow, and you know, they had that he was, you know, he was like smiling a lot, and he was like really, you know, kind of had this happy, upbeat personality. But then he switched into that mode of like, well, I'm really interested in the vigilante because my mother was murdered, and like, you know, I want to have that kind of power to be able to figure out what happened. And I think Grant Gustin was a great choice as Barry Allen. And it, you know, looked super fun to have him in the suit and catching Oliver's arrow.
Yeah, that it's I'm definitely, I mean, next TV season, and I went from watching no TV shows. Well, right now I'm only watching two, but next year, I mean, whatever night those shows are on, I'm going to be in front of the TV.
I know, yeah. And speaking of the shows, we talked about Gotham last week. We have another one we're going to talk about this week that pretty excited about.
I'm assuming you mean Constantine?
I do, but we're not getting there quite yet.
Sorry, I guess I was at the future's end of that conversation.
So Flash looks great. The suit looks good. Looks good in action. I mean, it was like a minute long clip, but I think it's gonna be good. It's gonna be fun. I do too. And we're gonna have, you know, some other superheroes in that show as well. We already have hints of Vibe, which is odd to me. They're going with Vibe.
Kind of works. Kind of works. Barry's powers can deal with vibration. Vibe is vibration, and whether or not he becomes Vibe in the show, which I imagine that they might go with it eventually.
Right. It's just a funny character to pick, Vibe.
I think Geoff Johns is very intent on making Vibe something, though he's kind of vanished in the comics.
Right.
Which seems to happen. Geoff Johns takes this character and he's like, this is going to be the new It character. He shows up for like 10 seconds and then vanishes. The same thing happened to the new Aqualad that was in, you know, Brightest Day.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They rebooted the universe and it's like, well, he doesn't exist anymore.
There was never a black Aqualad.
Yeah, which is, it's just weird to me because I was like, I think that character would have really caught on.
Oh, you yeah.
Know? Whether through Young Justice, you know, which obviously ended, you know, or just keeping him in the comics, I guess this is going to be a little side tangent real quick. What I've seen DC struggling with is a sense of range. A lot of their books kind of feel the same almost.
Okay.
There's very few books that kind of set their own definition. In one sense, it's like, writers like Scott Snyder or Grant Morrison or like Jeff Lemire have kind of had the opportunity to sort of define the books by their authorial voice. Mm-hmm. But then everything else in DC's line kind of toes that line where it's like, oh, well, Scott Snyder was really successful. And, you know, our three main characters of the cell are like Superman and Batman. And so everything else has to kind of, it's very almost like the 90s where everyone was kind of aping Rob Liefeld, you know, to varying levels of success, if not superiority. And so now it's like, if it's not one of like the few authorial voices DC has, everything else kind of falls in that same aesthetic. Whereas like, you want to make a Teen Titans book, sure, you know, you can deal with mature subject matter, but it should be a book that actually truly caters to teens.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that was kind of the original point. Was,
yeah, exactly.
You know, like comics were getting kind of a little more towards the adult because you had people who were now growing up their whole lives with Batman and Superman. And so it's like, man, you know, so those characters kind of matured naturally with it. And so, yeah, they're like, hey, Teen Titans, look, for the younger audience, they can still relate.
Exactly. And now, I mean, frankly, the audience that was there when, you know, when DC was National Periodicals, you know, when Superman and Batman were first coming out, I mean, the audience, I'm sure some people from that generation are still reading, if not, you know, a little bit later into that generation, if you want to count them as the original comic reading generation that hung on.
Right.
But in many ways, like, I'm sorry, but like they're kind of on their way out, you know, so to speak. I don't want like alienate anyone that might actually be within that generation that
they're not listening to this show. Don't worry.
They figure out a podcast.
Yeah, they don't.
But
Pod, you know, what?
I mean, at this point, it's sort of like, I don't know. They just, DC needs to, and I think that's what Marvel's been really succeeding at, is love it or hate it, or equality as far as each individual title standing on its own goes, they basically say each book has to have its own unique mission statement. The artists from book to book vary wildly, all of them, because they're all so distinct.
Wait, hold on. You didn't disconnect, but there was a sort of blackout in your talk in there for a second. So you're saying like the artists will vary from book to book.
Their artistic aesthetic, their styles. You've got Mike Del Mundo on Elektra, who's, I don't even know how to describe his artwork. It's very dreamlike. It's very surreal, but it's very clear, and the story is so fluid. Versus David Aja, on Hawkeye. I think what Marvel did was they took Hawkeye, not Hawkeye. Though Clint Barnes is not a bad
Hawk.
Damn it.
We tried. It's over. Keep going.
Hawk guy. No.
Okay, anyway.
Clint Barnes' book, and they said that this is going to be a book with a very unique voice, and it's not like on fire. It's not a fire sale or whatever the right term is. It's not blowing the doors off, but it's actually one of the few books that have actually increased in readership issue by issue, whereas most books shed readers over time.
Right.
So I think they've kind of looked at that as like, not every book is going to succeed, but the more diverse we allow our line to be, the more people are going, the more they're going to feel like they're actually getting something unique out of each experience.
Right.
And I just want DC to do that. And I think that's also what would bring it more into a modern sensibility, where it really is all about diversity and choice.
Mm-hmm. And the thing, I mean, it's not to say, like, we don't know, like, DC could get there. Comics change so much, decade to decade.
Yeah.
If you look at, the 90s compared to now, we're in this glorious age of comic books compared to how crappy the 90s were. I mean, my concern a little bit with Marvel is that Marvel's looking at Hawkeye and, the very casual tone of it, and their idea is now, like, let's inject this casual tone into other books. And I know, like, you're a huge fan of She-Hulk, and we'll talk about that later. Looking at the show notes here. And, I liked the first She-Hulk book, like, well enough, but it wasn't grabbing me. But I just see them now thinking, like, what other heroes that aren't, on the Avengers can we start telling stories about their everyday lives? And I could see that becoming a trend for them that wouldn't necessarily be a great idea.
Yeah, it's definitely something where you don't, like, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, Marvel characters have always especially excelled at having readers identify with the personal struggles of the characters,
right? Yeah.
Over it as they also sort of try to mingle with their superhero identities. I think that they're going to use Hawkeye, Clint Barton as a blueprint, but. Obviously it's going to come to varying levels of success. And the way that, Clint Barnes' book is basically, him kind of being sort of like the slacker, guy when he's on the Avengers, whereas like She-Hulk is more, she's a lawyer. Like, she's a lawyer. So it's almost like she will be more productive than Clint Barnes is.
Right.
In a sense. So it's touching on, let's look at this character's personal life, but what their personal life is can vary very much from book to book. But you can see little touches, like I was telling you about the Black Widow book from the past week,
right,
where she's been mostly doing missions during like the first six issues, but they've done little touches where she does hold down an apartment. There's this cat that keeps trying to get into her apartment, and they even have Clint Barton show up in one of the issues just randomly, and like in the side. And so they definitely are playing with, like, really putting that personal touch in the foreground.
Right. And I mean, I think that's kind of nice right now, because it's kind of allowing us a breather, especially with the cinematic universe focusing so much on the big action. But, I could feel like after a while people would pick up, like, a book and be like, that's great that she's trying to figure out what to order for dinner. I just want to see them punch somebody.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. How did we get on this from talking about the Flash showing up in the the commercial for
well
next.
he moves very fast, and I imagine in a way we're embodying the Flash because he must think about like 3,000 things a second.
Yeah, I really liked the Flash Reborn series. Here's another tangent. The Flash Reborn series, when it first starts off, he's standing in the he's standing like in a museum, and he's looking around, and everybody's like on their phone and they're doing all this stuff at once, and Hal Jordan comes up and he's like, you feel like you've been gone for so long, the world's going by so fast, like, is it all crazy? And he's like, are you kidding me? Like, the world's finally starting to catch up.
Oh, I remember that. That was a good line.
Yeah, that was fun. Okay, I'm going to force us to shift topics here.
Shifting.
Because this is a topic that I might talk for a little bit on, and we've got a heck of a lot of news to talk about. So I'm going to try and limit myself from talking for too long about this.
Okay.
So I went and saw The Amazing Spider-Man 2 today. Amazing Spider-Man 2, The Electro Boogaloo, as I would like to call it. And my immediate response, and I texted you this, is that I honestly did not love it. I kept myself very neutral going in. I saw that the critic reviews were very low. You had said you really enjoyed it. Scott Snyder tweeted out that he enjoyed it. People were just very, the rating on IMDb is like a 7.5. So that means that people, an audience at large, enjoyed it. But I fear that might kind of be the reason. Like, I was talking to someone about Wolverine, and they were like, yeah, that Origins movie, it had Wolverine punching stuff with his claws, and that's all I wanted out of it. And it's like, they weren't looking for this greater movie that we've now seen superhero movies can be. And that's, I feel maybe that's kind of people's response to Amazing Spider-Man 2. Because I didn't think it was, sadly, amazing. So let's talk about this. So I made a list of some stuff that I thought was good and some stuff that I thought was bad. Because I really did think there was some really good stuff here. And I thought three of the biggest points were Peter Parker, Gwen Stacy, and Aunt May. I thought that those three characters, they did a really great job with, and you had told me before you felt like they were really great character moments, and I absolutely agree. I thought Peter's interactions with Gwen Stacy and Peter's interactions with Aunt May were really well done. And I really liked that Spider-Man, one of my biggest complaints with Amazing Spider-Man 1 is that when he was Spider-Man, he wasn't making those jokes. He did it once, but it didn't really feel like Spider-Man too much, like he's having fun with this. And I felt like they did that so much better in this one. He's making the little comments. He's talking to the people. He's interacting with the cops. They did such a good job with that. I really loved the scene when he saves the little kid from the bullies. And he's like, oh, you made this? Like, hey, let me walk you home. Like, that was probably the most perfect Spider-Man moment in the movie. And that was great. I loved it. And I thought they used his powers very cleverly. Like when one of his web shooters was broken, and so he uses the other one, and he like puts his thumb on it, and it sprays out in all these directions. So Peter Parker, Gwen Stacy, Aunt May. I also thought that the big tragic event that happened was one of the better parts because it was very well handled. But now onto the list of, and I'm not going to say what the big bad thing was, but it's all over the internet. Spoil it for yourselves, folks. Since this movie is less than a month old, I'm not going to spoil anything. I think that should be kind of our rule for a big thing like a movie. We should maybe wait a month. What do you think?
I think the first episode of every new month, we will go, oh yeah,
here's what we were talking about.
Oh, by the way.
So comics, I think we're going to give 1 to 2 weeks, depending on how big the event is. Movies, we'll give a month because, that's kind of a bigger thing.
At the same time, plenty devil's advocate here. I feel like if anyone's going to come to our podcast, they have hopefully read what they wanted to read.
We're hopeful, but I think we should be mindful of spoilers.
Okay.
We can discuss that off air. So
Snape killed Dumbledore.
How dare you? Someone spoiled that for me before I read it.
Yeah, I don't remember if someone spoiled it for me, if I spoiled it for myself.
At this point, it doesn't matter. We already knew. So the things with Amazing Spider-Man 2 that did not wow me. I felt that it was not really a Spider-Man movie. I thought in the beginning it was, in the end it was, but in that middle, it was a Peter Parker movie, which is, fine to a degree, but I would rather that it's an alternating Peter Parker Spider-Man movie. And looking back at previous Spider-Man films, for some reason now people are like, oh, the Sam Raimi films were big steaming piles of crap. Which I love Spider-Man 1 and 2, the Sam Raimi ones. I thought they were great. I think we owe a big debt of gratitude to those movies for helping usher in this current age of superhero movies. But one thing I think about Spider-Man 2 is there's all these scenes where he is out rescuing people, where he's dealing with Doc Ock, like spurst into the movie periodically. Along with him dealing with all of his Peter Parker issues. And I felt like in this one, he had his initial confrontation with Electro, and then, then he had the final confrontation with Electro. And, there's stuff I don't want to go out of order and kind of my thoughts here. So speaking of Electro, I really thought there were too many people in this movie, and there was no clear villain. I don't really know who was supposed to be the bad guy in this, like to point like, oh yeah, that was the bad guy the whole time. Like I because they were kind of introduced and then ushered off, and then we kept paying attention to them. And I felt like in Amazing Spider-Man 1, we were always with Kurt Connors, and Peter had this emotional connection with him that I don't think that emotional connection was resonating. Like, we had Electro who kinda, but then goes off to a prison and is getting tortured for a while for no reason whatsoever. And he suddenly hates Spider-Man. And then you have Harry Osborn, who's brought in, who apparently doesn't need bodyguards, even though I imagine people are trying to constantly get at him. And Peter's on later on is like, oh, Harry's my best friend. It's like, is he though? We've had like one scene of you guys talking, and like you guys referenced that you had a past together. It's like I felt they could have maybe done some flashbacks or something, because he's like, you were there for me when my parents died. And it's like that really could have been, I don't know, I think we could have seen some flashback. I just didn't get the sense that like they were best of buds. Oh, I thought it was really nice of the eels to fix Electro's teeth. Like they made a point of that to show you the gap in his teeth fixing. Which I thought was ridiculous.
Thanks, Eels.
When they were showing the promotional images for the movie, and they kept showing Electro as Max Dillon before he becomes Electro, I thought he looked so much like a cartoon character with the glasses and the comb over, and I still felt like that in this. And then it's like, yeah, he gets bit by the eels, and all that goofy stuff is just gone. It's like, why even give him the gap? Electro was weirdly musical. I have that as a note.
It was
Like
what?
he was weirdly musical, like when he was in Times Square, there was like all that music like playing around that's supposed to be his thoughts. And then when they were fighting in the power plant, he's like shooting between all like the power turbines or whatever, and like it's all these different notes.
I actually thought that was cool.
It was interesting, but it just felt very random.
I mean, I guess because if you think that it wasn't previously established that like Max Dillon had a music affinity,
Right. And yeah. I'm kind of nitpicking here, which is what I didn't want to do, because I mean you can nitpick every movie. So here's just a couple more big complaints I had. They changed what the spiders were all about from the first one, which I thought was really weird.
What do you mean?
Like in the first one, it's like, hey, these spiders are produced like they've been genetically enhanced, and they're producing this really strong web. And then one bit Peter and he turned into Spider-Man. And this one, it was like we were breeding these spiders all along for this super secret purpose. But then they were never like, but it didn't work out, so now we're going to use them because their silk's really powerful. Like.
I mean, I don't think one negated the other. It was that they were keeping Peter's father's project alive, and then they decided not to. I think they shut it down after the Connors incident,
Well,
because
yeah,
they, but yeah.
but I mean, like the project was like 18 years old at that point, and like he's like, I tried to kill most of them. Like, how many did you have? There were like 100 in that room. Do you need like 300 spiders?
He had a lot of spiders. Dude, some people just have a lot of spiders. Okay. Okay. All right. Just had a lot of spiders. I totally see what you're... do you want to... You said you have some more big points?
Yeah, I have the...
The biggest?
Yeah, this is the biggest one, which I thought their handling of the Green Goblin was terrible. I was not a huge fan of Harry Osborn. I love the actor. I thought the actor did a fine job. But his first scene with his father was very uneven. I don't know what feelings I was supposed to be getting from that scene. It was just kind of awkwardly written and a little choppy. And then like later when he becomes the Goblin, they did what they did to Venom in Spider-Man 3. It's like, hey, we're going to throw him in for the last 10 minutes of the movie. Just have fun with that. I wasn't the look we'd seen the look previous, but actually seeing it in film, I thought was not great. I clearly have that they venomed him in my notes here.
They venomed him.
Yeah. And I don't know. I just didn't like that. He knows how to use the glider perfectly. He, you know, is suddenly like willing to kill everything and everyone, because I get like he made him crazy, but apparently like everything in this universe makes you crazy.
Unless you're Spider-Man.
That's right, exactly. Then like it makes you totally normal, but well, you have spider powers.
I guess if I get to that point, one thing that it's, and I can't speak to like the intention of the creators here. I do think that it was a flawed movie. I feel that it definitely the transformation of the characters, as maybe it wasn't the strongest transitions, but it totally fell on the work of like Jamie Foxx and Dan DeHaan. I agree that like Green Goblin felt kind of like a tacked on afterthought, even though he was involved in one of the biggest points of the movie.
Yeah, and
it was sort of like we want to follow this classic plot point, but we don't really want to spend an entire movie on it. But we really want this character to be involved in how it happens. But we want Electro to be the main bad guy. Okay, but you know, then we're going to put this in. So from a structural standpoint, that didn't help. I think their sort of shorthand or their shortcut to being like, they go from, you know, Max Dillon goes from weirdo, disturbed, creepy guy that no one ever pays attention to big and loud and powerful and not really knowing what to do with it, but just deciding that he's really angry and now he finally has a means to vent his frustration. You know, he was already disturbed and unhinged to begin with. Mm-hmm. So the transformation, especially when you fall into a vat of electric eels. I first personally thought that it was enough of a stretch that
electric eels would give this to him.
Well, no, that I mean, he's already clearly a very traumatized, disturbed person going through a very massive, you know, where he goes from having, say, the normal electrical output of a human body to like three cities worth. Mm-hmm. You know, that's got to do something to you. And if you're already kind of crazy to begin with, it's only going to make it worse.
But did he need, like, they were very unclear on this. Was he needing more electricity, or could he just absorb it?
I guess they weren't that clear. I think it was just that he in some ways was craving more power. Because if you're assuming that his body, even though technically he could disperse his body and bring it back together, he needs energy to do that, I imagine. They didn't necessarily specify that, but I'm assuming that he's operating at such a high level, he's going to need the constant energy. Like, he's giving it off, but it has to come from somewhere, and it has to go somewhere. And, you know, he's going to need to refuel.
Right. So and I just love that, like, when he's fighting in Times Square, it's like, he suddenly decides, hey, I'm going to be a villain, so I'm going to start trying to shoot off, you know, witty one-liners when he's like, now it's time to light the candles. It's like, was that necessary?
there was some clunky dialogue. I again, in the Times Square scene, I think that they were showing that he was just like, holy shit, I don't know what's going on. And then,
right, no, and, okay. And they were doing that so well when, like, once Peter Parker was trying to talk him down.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, okay, I thought the Spider-Man scenes were really, like, good. Mm-hmm. I really did. But I felt like there was other stuff that was not as good in this movie. And there wasn't enough Spider-Man.
Like, yeah, I feel like there's never enough Spider-Man in these movies. Even in the Raimi ones. And I think that they tell themselves, we need to kind of temper these scenes with Peter Parker moments to make you really want the Spider-Man ones. But then they don't get enough Spider-Man. Like, Spider-Man 3 kind of suffered from this. I did not think there was barely any Spider-Man in Spider-Man 3.
Right.
But as far as if you take all Spider-Man movies together, this is probably my best, my most favorite version of Spider-Man. As far as
Really?
his, like, I don't even know, I liked Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, and there's some
Oh, you're talking about
classic moments.
Andrew Garfield.
But I mean, I love Andrew Garfield, but I mean, as far as the Spider-Man moments
Yeah, no,
in the
and
whole.
yeah, and that's what I'm kind of saying. Like, I thought that they did a great job with, like, some of those moments were so well done. But I was wanting more of them.
No, I totally feel you. I feel you.
So I mean, I'm not sorry, I'm not quite ready to shift off this topic yet. What was I gonna say about shoot, Spider-Man? Some of the scenes were super awkward with Peter Parker. Mainly the one I'm thinking about is when him and Harry first like reunite. It's like not just like awkward, like we haven't seen each other in years. It's like they were super awkward first talking to each other. Did you get that feeling?
Yeah, I think one thing they do in this movie is they kind of let, like, the peak, they really, like, lean on Peter being this, like, socially awkward person.
Right,
So
which
it's
is
just sort of like
now.
a, hey. Oh, wait, let me talk a little bit more than just hey. Like,
Right. Yeah.
it was awkward. I got what they were trying to do. And again, like, the strength of, well, I'm not calling it a superior script, but the strength of the script ended up on the character's shoulders. And as I think it would have been better if they'd actually, they didn't establish in the first Spider-Man that Peter, beyond the fact that his dad apparently worked for Oscorp, had any personal, connection to the company. Like, he didn't know who Kirk Connors was. I feel like maybe in some levels, like, he would have heard of Kirk Connors. I
Right.
mean, yeah, he was young when, when his parents disappeared, but I feel like it would have been a complete mystery. Though I think Uncle Ben knew who Kirk Connors was. And then, but if the if he did have a childhood friendship with the son of the CEO, president, and owner and founder of the company,
Right.
a childhood friendship, like,
Right, yeah, they made it seem like they knew each other really well.
That, and I believe they established that the friendship happened after his parents disappeared.
Well, but
So,
see, they were unclear on that because you would think that they like knew each other before because he was like, "Hey, you were really there for me when my parents died."
well,
Like,
they said, did he say that? Because they basically said it had been 10 years. So if they're
well,
like 19, 20 in the movie, I mean, Peter had to have been like 6 or 7, I think, when they died. They never really specify how
yeah,
old he was
I don't know. Well,
by then.
yeah, the time in that movie was really bizarre.
I agree. They don't really specify the passage of time between, like, them graduating and.
Right, like oh, like because they made it kind of seem like oh, it's just one summer, but you don't know because Harry, when Harry returns, he's like he's 20.
Yeah.
They mention that he's 20, and it's like so is are they the same age? Is Peter also 20?
Yeah, that part, I caught on to that. That kind of threw me off. So yes, there were things in the film that weren't perfect. What I've kind of discovered for me is that, like, I definitely can pick out, like, a bad film, but I can forgive a film for plot holes and things like that, as long as it's well-paced, emotionally resonant, and keeps me engaged. I had the same thing with The Dark Knight Rises. Like, I think Dark Knight Rises did better structurally than Amazing Spider-Man 2. It, the more, the couple times after that I watched it, I started to see some of the problems that were being pointed out, but I still forgave them because, I mean, if you saw me in the theater when I was watching that movie, and the same thing with Amazing Spider-Man, I was on the edge of my seat. I was engaged. I cared about the characters. I was totally into it. And then afterwards, I was like, I really love that movie. Okay, but I can see where this, and this may have been,
Right.
bad.
Yeah, but I in my initial viewing, I cared about like the main characters, but looking even back at Amazing Spider-Man 1, like I felt for Dr. Connors and like you know, he has that very obvious flaw of like he's missing an arm and he's trying to heal it and he almost does, but then things go terribly wrong. I really like that. And then I felt they kind of tried to do the same thing with Harry, but it didn't work in
Well,
this one.
I read in, like, in one person's comment or something like that, that the scene with his father was kind of establishing that it was already too late for Harry. You know, he had his whole life in Europe, and, like, he was a player, and
Right.
was just a troubled kid with like sex and drugs or whatever, mm-hmm. that he was already messed up by the time he entered the movie. And the fact that he all of a sudden had a very accelerated degenerative disease, which was really weird.
It was weird because we see pictures or like video of Norman Osborn in like, you know, his later age, and he looked fine. Like, he, you know, his hand was shaking. He had the cane, whatever.
Yeah.
But he looked fine.
I think they kind of established that for whatever reason, Harry's was accelerating faster than normal.
No, or it seemed, because he asked him, like, is your hand already shaking? Because it's, you know, it's at this age that you start to notice.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they point that out, but then it also the vibe I got was that Harry's was accelerating faster. They didn't directly touch upon it, but I mean, he was much farther gone, like, as by the time he was invading Oscorp, you know, than certainly his father was for several decades.
Yeah, So why is Oscorp obsessed with animals? Like, even to the point where they're making their technology in the shape of it.
I don't know. I totally get what they're trying to do with, like, Oscorp is the evil empire, you know, where all bad stuff comes from Oscorp. But like,
it's a little much.
You kind of draw a line. I mean, the fact that they would intentionally have both like vulture wings and octopus arms
and the rhino,
like that. Again, like, I see what you're doing there.
Right.
It's okay for threats to come from other sources. Right.
Like, it would have totally, like, because, you know, you have, I still think Paul Giamatti was the weirdest choice in the world for Rhino, especially since it ended up being such a bit part. But, you know, like, if he was a Russian mobster, if it was like, hey, the Russian mob has put all of their money and, like, they've kidnapped a couple Oscorp scientists to develop this thing, and, like, I felt that would have been a little bit better than, like, everything evil, like you're saying, like, everything evil comes from Oscorp.
Yeah.
Everything evil and animal-shaped comes from Oscorp.
Yeah. You know, actually, that would have been a really great idea with, like, the Russian mob trying, almost kind of like a Dark Knight scene, where, like, all the gangs are trying, basically putting their trust in the Joker. It's sort of like, the Russian mob's like, Spider-Man's a really big thorn in our side. We kind of need our own, you know, supervillain to fight with. And they pick the Rhino.
I know, right? So bizarre. Really sad. J. Jonah Jameson was not in it. And I thought...
Funny that they do touch upon him, though, that he does exist and he does have a relationship with Peter.
Right. It also really bothered me in Peter's email. This is a nitpick thing. I apologize, people. I just thought it was odd that Peter's like, here's some new, like, pictures. Like, he says pics, but he spells it P-I-X. I'm like, this guy's giving you money, man. Put the extra letter in there.
Yeah.
Also, the Felicia. I don't really know how I feel about the Felicia Easter egg.
I don't know if it's supposed to be Felicia Hardy or not. Like, I'm assuming that's what they're going for.
But they drew enough attention to it that I feel like it's supposed to be. Like, there was kind of a pause after it's like, what's your name? Felicia. Huh?
Yeah, no, I think it's that maybe she was, I think she was kind of playing her own game there, mm-hmm. but it was so subtle that, like, if you didn't know that Felicia was a reference to something in Spider-Man, you would have been like,
right, you would have been like, oh, that's her name.
It's weird that they keep spending so much time on this secretary.
Yeah. You know? Greed. Okay, now, in the sake of time, I will move us off into news, and I'm sure we won't talk about all of this, or we'll just talk about some of this real quick. Before we do, I have come up with new trivia to ask you.
Oh boy.
Boy, we're just gonna do two questions this time.
Do you got three questions? I'll do three questions.
I can do three. These are Spider-Man questions, appropriately. All right.
Okay.
Where is it here? When Spider-Man was first offered membership in the Avengers, he was required to catch what superpowered being as a test?
Hulk.
Oh, wow. Good job. That is correct.
Sweet.
He does capture the Hulk. Spider-Man is suspicious of what the Avengers want with the green-skinned monster. Feeling pity for the creature, Spider-Man decides to release him instead of turning him over to the Avengers, thus failing the test.
Yep. I'm trying to remember. I actually read that story, and I can't remember. It was in, like, a book of collected Spider-Man stories.
Yeah, it's Amazing Spider-Man Annual No. 3. Who gave Spider-Man a pep talk after he was defeated by his very first encounter with Doc Ock?
Gave Peter a pep talk or Spider-Man?
Spider-Man gave Spider-Man a pep talk.
After his first encounter with Doc Ock. Oh, this is going a bit further back.
Yeah, this one's really old.
Betty Brant?
No, the Human Torch.
What? Really? Like in the Spider-Man comic?
I mean, Amazing Spider-Man number 3, Spidey is badly beaten in his first ever encounter with Doc Ock. Mentally defeated, Peter questions his ability to go on as Spider-Man until he attends a school assembly where the Human Torch is giving a speech. So he didn't even give him a pep talk. The Torch encourages the students to never give up, even when things seem tough. Peter takes this message to heart and a rematch defeats Doc Ock. All right, that was kind of a dumb one.
That but that's actually a really interesting thing to know. I didn't realize that their relationship went back that far.
Yeah, they've always been kind of buddy buddy. Which okay, I didn't want to keep talking about Amazing Spider-Man, but Gwen Stacy's speech was I don't know, it was weird because knowing she was gonna die, it just like it's so like purposefully written.
You totally just spoiled. The thing you said was you're right. You're, as far as the speech goes, it's weird that someone would give a speech that I wrote, you know, from a
story. It's like that's that specific.
That it's just like, yeah, like, do what you gotta do because you're gonna die someday.
Oh, I'm really sorry, folks. Oops. Maybe I'll edit that out. Probably not.
No, in the fairness, I mean, who didn't see it coming? That's the thing. You see it coming, but as far as the Peter Gwen and even just the Gwen situation goes, like, you just don't want her to die.
Right. No,
there's gotta be a way. We can see Spider-Man in London. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. When they're like, I'm gonna go to London, I'm like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Okay. One last question, then we're gonna move on. Okay. What other superhero helped Spider-Man the first time he fought the Ringmaster and his circus of crime?
Daredevil.
Did you just pull that out of your butt?
Am I right?
You're right.
I actually think I knew that, but forgot that I knew it. Not thinking of the Ringmaster.
I have no idea. I'm on like this Spider-Man trivia page, and I was just looking for some questions.
I'm looking at the Ringmaster. I didn't really know him that well, but something about Daredevil, it just seemed like a kind of crap Daredevil would get involved in.
He can't see. He doesn't know. He just wanders on accidentally. All right, we're moving on here. We probably should have talked about Constantine in the last section, but hey, whatever. Constantine's happening. There's a trailer out. It looks pretty good.
It was a pretty long trailer. I was surprised. I felt like they were giving a lot. Like, it was a lot of, like, teasing, but
right.
Well, it was a fairly full, meaty trailer.
It's, for, you know, it's only for the first episode, but it's really, because Constantine, there was a movie, sure, but he's not a super well-known character.
Yeah.
And I
can see the show struggling. I mean, like, watching the trailer, like, I'd be like, I definitely want to see where that goes. I've never been a big, like, a cult person. Like, I've always been fascinated by magic, like, magic-based stories, but... Mm-hmm. But I mean, we're gonna have to see. I think I'm definitely excited.
Well, but that audience is huge. Like Supernatural is going on what? It's like 10th season.
If they can pull the Supernatural crowd over, right. And I've never watched Supernatural, so I don't know. Like, you know, is it like the hokey kind of fun?
Oh no.
Because like, is it to take itself fairly serious?
Yeah, I mean, I've only seen probably most of the first season, a little bit into the second. So I haven't really even seen where it hits its stride, but they're pretty good. I mean, they're pretty good with it being, you know, having a very dark tone.
Mm. Well, I don't know. What do you think of Constantine?
I don't really know the character that well, but based on like the trailer, I think that it looks like a lot of fun. It does look genuinely creepy. I mean, American Horror Story is super popular, so I think maybe there's trying to jump onto that a little bit. I'm pretty excited because we're getting a pretty true representation of the character from what I understand. I mean, yeah, he doesn't smoke. People are going to have to get over it. I mean, he might in the future. That could be a thing that they win. Who knows? You know, we only saw a 3-minute trailer. But, you know, I'm genuinely interested. Where, like, Gotham, I'm interested. I'm a little excited, but there's still some cautious optimism because it's like, oh, they're trying to fit a lot in there into Gotham that, I mean, maybe, you know, once it settles, it'll probably pad out a lot more. But Constantine looks a lot more like, you know, since we don't know the character that well, it's like they're just going to kind of have fun with this.
It can really go in any direction.
Yeah.
Big iconic characters you feel like you have to follow. And I think that may have been one of the things that Amazing Spider-Man 2 struggled with, was the creators felt like they only could operate within this classic story, that Gwen Stacy had to die. So we...
Well, now I can't bleep it out at all.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, but whatever. She died.
Guys. It happened. People, get over it.
It's time to move on. You know, they have to work within this secure structure. Whereas with Constantine, yes, he had like a 300 issue long running series. He now has his rebooted one within the New 52. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think unless you talk to like maybe a diehard Constantine fan, which they do exist. You know, they really don't have to fall. They can feel more inspired than dictated by, you know?
Right.
And the same thing goes for with Arrow, you know, Green Arrow with Arrow. And I think even with Flash, like, you can touch on some classic moments, but you can really do it your own way.
Mm-hmm. And that's
going to feel unique.
Yeah. And that's what's kind of really nice about, you know, where we're at now with these television shows and these movies is, they're not so held on to, and you know, they might take a little bit, but they're really going to discover their voice. And people, you know, everybody's saying really like Arrow's really coming to its own this season. And I think, you know, if Constantine does well enough, which I think it very well could, if it does well enough to continue on past the first season, it's really going to find its fitting. I think Gotham has the potential to do the same. So I think they're going to be shows to keep an eye on for sure. And people are saying, you know, you and I have both said that we're not a big Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fan based on what we've seen. But people are saying that the season finale was good, that it really kind of was finding its voice in the last couple episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe over the summer I'll jump on it. Maybe next season I'll kind of keep an eye on what's going on. But
seems like a good thing to kind of pass some time in the summer.
Yeah. You know, while I'm waiting for more Arrow, because I love Arrow.
Love it.
And so that's pretty exciting. That's, I mean, I don't really know anything about iZombie. iZombie is also getting a show.
I've read the first volume, but I guess they're taking like the very basic core elements
probably
of like
a good idea.
The concept and then doing their own thing with it.
That's probably a good idea.
I mean, I don't know if you knew, but there was actually Chris Roberson, the creator of iZombie with Mike Allred, actually kind of developed a beef with DC just before the New 52 reboot.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, he had his book, and I don't know if it was because iZombie was getting canceled or what the case was. Like, he was write an arc of the Fable spinoff, Ferris, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that in the pipeline, and he actually took over from J. Michael Straczynski during the Superman Grounded arc. And somewhere in there, it's been a while, like that's obviously been like 2-3 years now when this happened, but some sort of editorial interference. It was almost like a precursor to a lot of the junk we hear going on now since the New 52 started with editorial interference. But it basically amounted to something like that on Chris Roberson's side. And so he parted ways and then felt the need to address it publicly. And then it actually amounted to his Ferris story being scrapped. I don't remember if iZombie was already canceled at that point or shortly after. But basically he's actually since sort of walked away from, the big two, and he's actually developed his own comic company called Monkey Brain, which basically almost exclusively works through Comixology. And that's sort of the rest, you know, the rest is history. But anyway, so iZombie is actually a creation of Chris Roberson. So despite being actually a fairly cool high concept, it's interesting that sort of out of everything on DC's slate, they're going with this particular franchise that, you know, one wasn't super successful in the comics and also kind of has a bit of baggage attached to it. Not that every character doesn't have some kind of behind the scenes baggage attached to it.
Right, no, they all do. So yeah, I mean, I just felt like mentioning that because it's, you know, comic book news, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. Yeah, who knows?
Who knows?
What
were you going to say? I was looking at the list.
Oh, well, here, you know, I've been introducing everything. Why don't you go ahead, move us on?
I feel like maybe we should use the next episode to, like, do a really in-depth segment on this, but Ben Affleck as Batman for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should just do this as a teaser. Like, it looks pretty sweet.
Oh, the suit looks fantastic.
I'm really excited to see it in action. I'm okay with, they're going for a very distinct, particular, purposeful direction with Batman.
Right, they're going the Frank Miller route.
Yeah, it's not just, let's make a realistic Batman like the Christopher Nolan films, you know, rest in peace, but it's also, it's very much a, you know, we're really taking this very specific Batman and putting him into play.
Right. I think, visually, this is a Batman that is stepping right out of the pages of a comic, as far as, like, we've seen of the suit so far, and I cannot be more excited.
I think we should definitely, give us a week, and the next time we sit down and talk, I think there'll be a little bit of distance between it. We can really take it and dissect it.
Yeah.
I think that would be fun.
I agree. Now, I mean, we haven't really seen it in action yet, but that still photographs great. Okay. All right. We're not going to keep talking about it. We won't talk about the Agent Carter show because I'm not going to have anything great to say about it.
There's not a whole lot to go on based on the fact that, like, we're not really inclined to jump on the S.H.I.E.L.D. bandwagon. You know, I said one of those things where I'm just going to have to wait and see what they come up with.
Yeah, the premise is odd. I don't know where they're going with that.
Isn't it just, isn't it about the formation of S.H.I.E.L.D.? I didn't actually read the link on it.
Okay, so we're going to talk about this briefly. Because I feel like also the news is a little heavy-handed on the DC side this week. So Marvel announced that a new television show based in the Marvel Cinematic Universe called Agent Carter is in the works. And I'm just going to read the official synopsis that appeared on Deadline. It says, Marvel's Agent Carter, starring Captain America's Haley Atwell, follows the story of Peggy Carter. It's 1946, and peace has dealt Peggy Carter a serious blow as she finds herself marginalized when the men return home from fighting abroad. Working for the covert SSR, Strategic Scientific Reserve, Peggy must balance doing administrative work and going on secret missions for Howard Stark, all while trying to navigate life as a single woman in America in the wake of losing the love of her life, Steve Rogers. Blah, 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 blah. That's just, and after that, it's like inspired by Captain America. What?
I mean, it's the 1940s. Like, I don't think it's a big secret that, like, women weren't exactly, you know, treated that well as a society. It was the beginning of, you know, something new for sure. Mm-hmm. I can see, you know, they inevitably would have to approach it from that direction where men are going to be her obstacle simply because it's, you know,
because of the time period it's in.
The time period, you know.
Right. This is going to be very, she's doing it for herself. Like, tough, you know, strong woman.
Which, you know, I think personally, I think that's fine.
Right.
I think it's the synopsis that kind of makes it seem like really heavy-handed because you want to see a strong independent woman. Right. You know, you want to see that kind of character, you know, sort of be a fictionalized version of the real world woman that said, you know what, I think we're done with this chapter in our history. Let's start something new. I just think when it comes to writing a synopsis for a dramatic TV series, it's like, she ain't, you know, letting that man say that no more, you know?
Right.
So reading it now, it is kind of like, it's almost saying like, she, you know, her obstacle are men, but her biggest obstacle is the love she had for a man.
Right.
You know, kind of like saying this is a tough as nails independent woman who struggles with her affection for men.
Right.
It's really weird.
Yeah, I feel like just with everything else that Marvel has going on, this is just an odd direction to now kind of be focusing on.
Yeah, it's again, I want to wait and see because it could end up being something really special.
Right. Yeah, we'll see.
But as far as like Agents of Shields go, I feel like this, I mean, they have so many characters in their Rolodex, so to speak, that the fact that we already have a show about Shield, they could be doing, some flashbacks in Agents of Shield to show the early Agents of Shields, including Peggy Carr, could be the center of that
Right.
within the same show. Whereas now they're basically, they're doing the same thing twice, albeit in different time periods.
Yeah.
That's a lot of resources. That's a lot of time to basically have a show predetermined.
Yeah.
That's a big thing, I think. Though I'm cool with stories being set in the past, but like, I like historical
Oh
dramas.
yeah, no, that's totally cool.
But I mean, when you just think of all the other, ways they could expand their universe, they're basically expanding on unnecessary information. So it's ultimately going to be a, if you really like the Peggy Carter character, this is where you're going to see more of her. If
Yeah.
you're looking at a true expansion of the Marvel Universe, because yes, they might put some things in the show that kind of be like, oh, this is really relevant to Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
It's kind of like, well, it can't really be that important. It's kind of like a aha moment than a, oh my God,
Right. Yeah.
Peggy Carter secretly Star-Lord's mother.
That's I know people who think that's what's gonna happen.
I don't know.
Know. So, moving on, because I don't think, yeah, we don't have much to say on it at this point. It's entirely speculation. So this next story, well, I'm actually reading the article for the first time. It might not be as exciting as I thought it was. Which the title of it is Gage Higgins Take Batman Beyond Weekly, Welcome Artist Phil Hester, which I thought meant we were getting a new Batman Beyond comic, which is not apparently what is happening. It
Yeah,
is,
no,
yeah.
it's a continuation of the same story they've been telling, which I kind of like. I have a bunch of the issues waiting to be read. I actually thought this Batman Beyond 2.0, actually, at least the first several issues, it was fairly entertaining, and eventually we'll get around to catching up on it. I
Yeah.
mean, the fact that Phil Hester's involved, and I'm totally down with Phil Hester interiors, though. I think it was Tony Silas, or Tony, I don't know if he goes by Tony Silas, even though it's Thonny. Or I'm assuming it's a he. I didn't like some work he did initially for Marvel, but I thought that his Batman Beyond work was really strong. So I don't know if they're going to be rotating, because I can't see Phil Hester being on this super long term, but
Right.
I think that's pretty cool. I'm interested to see where that goes.
Yeah, I really appreciate that they are keeping Batman Beyond and the character of Terry McGinnis alive. Because I think, they see that there's a lot of potential in that character, and there totally is. Especially when you take it to comics, you kind of have the chance to mature him a little bit and to take him through that maturity. Because in the show, you had to keep it kid friendly and like you couldn't do too much character development. He kind of had to stay static the whole time, so it's cool that they're keeping him on, and I think there's really some chance to do some cool stuff with him. And I really like what they're doing in Future's End, where they're showing us this like this more matured version of him. And so yeah, I think I kept up a little bit when they did the New 52 Batman Beyond, and I would love to dive back into it. So I'll have to do that and maybe report on that at a later date. But I really enjoy that cover, which is what that's oh gosh, who is that? It's from that Batman movie. Fantasia?
The Phantasm, Night of the Phantasm,
Is it Phantasm?
Night of the
I
Phantasm,
know it's not Fantasia.
Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Okay, yeah. And I really like I think it's interesting they're bringing that character back because that was a cool movie. I like it. I'm a fan. And speaking of
Christos Gage.
Christos Gage,
Christos Gage.
has said that there is going to be two new Superior Spider-Man issues.
What? Yep, I read that today. I got super excited. I mean, I totally see what they're doing. It, in a sense, it allows us to have this, I mean, we could see if Superior Spider-Man, comes back full time. Obviously, it's a little tricky now that Peter's back in control of his body, but basically the issues touch on this moment during the Spider-Man 2099 arc where Superior Spider-Man was displaced for like 9 hours. Supposedly in the year 2099, which it is, he was displaced
Yeah, that's what they say here in the
for 9
article.
hours. So two issues taking place in that time that could set up Otto for, a big return.
I don't, nah, I think it's too
But
soon.
I think, but I mean, with Spider-Verse coming in November, with all every legally capable Spider-Man appearing, I mean, on one hand, I think Mark could say there's not a better time than now. It's almost like they can sneak him in through all the noise and be like, "Ah, Superior Spider-Man's back full time. You get your cake and eat it too." How I feel about that personally is that I really could have, I think that if the book had been paced slower, I could totally have read Superior Spider-Man much longer. I loved his like his interactions with Peter's personal life really more than any of the big Spider-Man action. But seeing the big sweeping changes he made as Spider-Man, it's hard for me now to go back and to go and now read Amazing Spider-Man, where, I think they're really going to draw out Peter dealing with a lot of the consequences, both in his personal life and as Amazing Spider-Man, as the Amazing Spider as Spider-Man. But on another hand, it's still basically now at some point we're going to sweep that under the rug. Whereas in my mind, like as long as Otto is in control, things will always change. Whereas with putting Peter back in the shoes. Yes, he's going to be dealing with this, but his ultimate goal is to kind of back to as close to his status quo as possible. Maybe he'll keep the company, maybe he won't. We'll see. But I mean, what I enjoy so much was that Otto was he was kind of the anti-fan. He wasn't groveling over Peter's, quote unquote superiority. He was charting his own course, and it was different than anything we've ever seen Peter Parker do. And that was exciting. So getting a kind of a couple of issues that are potentially like a last hurrah of Otto as Spider-Man, I'm totally excited for.
Yeah, and it's really odd for as popular as Spider-Man is, for long how long he's been around, they are really willing to do some interesting stuff. And really try some stuff out. Like, I mean, like the Clone Wars saga, which, everybody loves the Clone Wars saga. Or just the Clone Saga, sorry, not Clone Wars. That,
Worse.
you
So,
know, when Luke
well, now,
Skywalker, when Luke
yeah.
Skywalker was Spider-Man? Remember that?
Yep. Well, now that that Disney owns Marvel and Star Wars,
Right, it could happen.
we could see Peter Park Sky Parker.
Peter Sky Parker, I love it. Which did you see that article that somebody did a comic? I think it was like one of the last Dark Horse Star Wars comics where they were doing the original story of Star Wars.
Oh yeah,
How it was supposed to originally be.
the Star Wars. Yeah.
Yeah, he
I
was
haven't
like
read it, but apparently it was pretty good.
he's Luke Starkiller. Like,
Yeah.
oh, that sounds so cool. I'm gonna have to read that.
Star Killer.
I know, it's such a cooler name. Anyway, yeah, I think really Spider-Man's been this character that they have been willing to throw some stuff at the wall and see what sticks.
See
And
what sticks.
hey, and but somehow he keeps rising. Like, people love this character so much that it's like, hey, we're going to like just dump crap on Spider-Man for like 4 years. And people are gonna be like, cool, I'll keep picking that up. Like, and then it'll be great again. Everyone's like, see, this is why I'm reading it. It's like, even though you just, wasted a bunch of time.
Yeah, I just think I think it's hard because comic books are so cyclical that, as much as I would love to get a continuing story of Peter Spider-Man at this point, like they made the concern, right, this chapter is over, back to Peter, what's done is done. It's like when they kill a character and they bring him back. When the death is done, effectively, I'm sad, like, especially if it's a character I really like, I don't want him to die. And of course, there's that cynical part of me, it's like, well, they'll be back. But I almost think like it was such a great death scene, and resurrections ultimately, like when you think about, how many people got resurrected in the real world,
Right.
there's not many. And you know, and it's such a huge, impactful thing. And I feel like it's not so much death that's lost its luster in comic books. It's the fact that these characters can be resurrected, whether they reveal that it was that they never truly did die, or that their energy was reconstituted back into their form. You know, whatever.
whatever stupid explanation they came up with.
Yeah, you know, whatever it is to bring it back. I mean, with Nightcrawler, they literally went to heaven and got him. You know, the same thing with Ben Grimm in the Fantastic Four with Mark Waid a long time ago.
God, that's such a weird story.
And it was. And, you know, and sometimes it's like with Colossus and Astonishing X-Men, it was, I never actually died. I sort of died, but I was revived. And they switched out my ashes. Like, right. And on one hand, they've come up with a not too convoluted reason on how they came back. But then you kind of look at that original death and you're just like,
no, that was just cheapened entirely. You know,
yeah, you just, I almost feel weird because I know they're going to come back, and the death was so powerful that I just want to exist. This is really morbid and weird, but like, I just want to exist in a world where this character doesn't come back.
Well, because that would be more interesting, and we'd have to deal with it, and the world would have to move on.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just not the case.
It's, you know, in the real world, we're forced to move on no matter what we want, no matter how desperately we want to return to that original status quo. You know, Doc ultimately came to some sort of character arc, which is hard for most characters in comics to actually go through a full arc. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then he's gone. And the fact that they could bring him back, for me, is just like, you know, like, there's a part of me that just wants to see the same thing over and over again. But I know, you know, objectively, like, it's better for the story this way.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can just have your cake.
Right.
Or you can just eat it. Or just be fine with one slice, Nick. Just be fine with one slice.
You don't need to eat that brownie sundae in a Burger King parking lot, Nick.
But I did. I did.
You have.
God. Oh, God.
And moving on, they have teased that there will be a new Robin by year's end. Peter J. Tomasi has said that with his whole conclusion with the current Ra's al Ghul story going on in the Batman And book will end with Robin Rises Omega, and that by December we'll be seeing someone else take on the role.
Robin Rises Alpha. Now... Right. Now, I feel like on some level you must be excited, but do you feel that a light now we're just getting a lot of smoke and mirrors that's ultimately going to be Damien resurrected, or that someone new will actually take on the costume?
I think it's going to be someone new. I don't think it's going to be Damien at this time.
Are you thinking Carrie Kelly might come back in the focus?
Maybe they introduce Stephanie Brown, which I really hope it's not. Take that, all you Stephanie Brown lovers. I mean, I don't know who it's going to be. There's definitely kind of some stuff going on with Batman Eternal, which, you know, what's going to happen there?
Well, it sounds like there was that Batman issue where they teased like a year into the future of Batman. It seems like a lot of the female characters are kind of asserting their own identity, so you
right.
Stephanie Brown is going to be Spoiler, Harper Row is going to be Bluebird, so right. It kind of leaves Robin to kind of be the boys club that, you know, that's almost basically always been, but they haven't really introduced any new male, you know, young male characters that could fill that role within the, you know, that we would want to care about in the next, you know, 6 months.
Right. I mean, and there's totally the room for it. It seems like the rising up is going to be within the whole Batman And book, just because, you know, it's because they're coming at it and saying like it's going to happen at Peter Tomasi's hand. So I mean, it could be Carrie Kelly.
Yeah, though I've sort of fallen off that book a little bit. It seemed like she was in it and then kind of disappeared for the Two-Face story, and then she's still kind of in the background, not really playing much of a role. Well, and I did read the couple of issues ago where Batman and Aquaman got to the island and fought dead whales and stuff.
Right, and in the newest one, they go to the Amazon Island, which I'm not going to try and pronounce.
Themyscira? Themyscira? Themyscira.
Knowing your pronunciations, that's probably incorrect.
But...
But, you know, whatever. Hawkeye.
I can't help that I'm, for some reason, oddly attracted to him.
Wow, that was strange.
Apparently that's the only explanation I can think of.
Anyway, we're talking about other stuff here. I'm pretty excited that there's going to be a new Robin. I don't think it's too soon, because Damian Wayne has now been dead for a while. I think the emotional attachment that's still there is just because it's Batman's son. I mean, not to say that he wouldn't care if it was like any other Robin, but the fact that it's still a big deal is because, you know, it's his son, like, and Ra's al Ghul's going after it because he wants his family back together so he can be all evil and menacing. I'm really enjoying this storyline and the way that it's going. It's kind of turned into like the Brave and the Bold, you know, with his different team ups with different heroes. I'm totally down for that.
Yeah, I thought that's been pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really like the thought. There's kind of an interview where, you know, the Comic Book Resources asks, like, the last time that Robin died, Tim Drake came up and became Robin because he, you know, says that Batman always needs a Robin. He's like, is that kind of your thought process here? And he's like, absolutely. And I agree. I think that there's definitely an aspect of that partnership that's very important to the character of Batman. And there's like thinking like there's this scene in Young Justice. I'm going to talk about it again. They're paying me, I wish. Where someone's, you know, someone's kind of asking Batman, like, why did you start off Dick Grayson so young and fighting crime? Like, was it, you know, like, why did you do that? And his response is, you know, he wanted justice for the people that killed his parents. And so, like, so then they ask him, like, so you were just trying to make him, like, just like you? And his response is, no, I'm trying to do the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Like, trying to show them that, like, what justice is, and that, yeah, I don't know. I really like it. It brings out the personal side of Batman that we don't really get to see in his interaction with other heroes. I'm down with it. All right.
Are you down with recommendation time?
Yeah, I was going to say, we're nearing our time here, so let's try to knock these out pretty quick.
All right, first.
Me first. Fantastic. My recommendation this week is the current New 52 run of Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman! Which is what they would say in the old 70s TV show. And I know that because we used to play it at a place I used to work all the time. Anyway, the new Wonder Woman of the New 52 is being written by Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chiang. That eye is throwing me off. Is pretty much the primary artist on it. It is really good. I know a lot of people have some issues with the New 52, but I'm a huge fan of this book. I've been picking it up in trades. For those who are unfamiliar with what they're going with in this new series, is that Wonder Woman is actually a child of Zeus. And Zeus at the beginning of the story has ceased to exist, yet everybody still has memories of him. And they even recognize in the book, like, that's pretty weird, but obviously there's some bigger force at work here. And so there's this whole war of who's going to be like the new king of the gods. And Wonder Woman is thrust in the middle of it, trying to bring an order and a balance, and, you know, not let her dick siblings like get in the, you know, have their own way, because they're all incredibly selfish. Mm-hmm. And I just think the representations of the gods are super cool.
Very unique.
Yeah, War is basically Brian Azzarello. If you've ever seen pictures of him, I think that one's the funniest to me.
Although that was good.
And I really like the way they did Hades, and Poseidon looks really cool. He's like this really big, like, frog beast. I just think that the direction on it visually is fantastic. The writing is really good. It's really, because Wonder Woman is a difficult character, because she's iconic in the sense that she's Wonder Woman, but I feel like you can't really say why she's super iconic. And this story has just been like, hey, we're gonna make her super awesome. and it's totally succeeded, and it's had its really bizarre moments and its dark moments, but all of it has worked, and I'm totally hooked every time I'm reading it. So yeah, check it out. Give some love to Wonder Woman. I mean, who doesn't want to give love to Wonder Woman? And hopefully, when we hear some more news about the movie, that maybe there will be an influence from this new run, which I think would be really cool and interesting to see them kind of try and tackle on screen. I'm a big fan of it. Go pick it up wherever Wonder Woman is sold, which is pretty much online or in comic book stores. Amazon.com also works. First three trades are out, so there's plenty of material to sink your teeth into. Run wild.
All right.
Yeah, we're keeping on a girl power theme today on the recommendations.
Yeah, I'm actually going with She-Hulk that we brought before.
Boo.
I'll be concise. I feel
Yeah,
that it's
that'll
a
be
book.
first.
Yeah, I know. I feel that it takes a character who, has struggled to have a long-running series, which I think I've spoken in the past, where I'm kind of beyond. That going with a very specific story to tell, I feel like Charles Soule has a very specific story to tell, and the execution of it is it's fun. It's yes, it's there's a goofiness to it, but it he's in a sense he's playing it as straightforward as you really can with sort of a character called She-Hulk. But as far as it goes, it really is kind of like a sort of like Law and Order CSI where they take. The real world like lawyer jargon and bits and try and mold it into and make sense with the Marvel Universe where not everything is always realistic. It's fun. Javier Paludo's art is, you might have a beef with his overall style, but his construction of story is very clear, very inventive, and very smooth. And so far the cast that Soule and Paludo are building around Jennifer Walters, who is She-Hulk, it's sort of offbeat. It's not overly glamorous, but it's almost like it's real people dealing with real issues. I guess that theme comes up again, but not shying away from the fact that the Marvel Universe is a very fantastic place. Anyway, there's only like three or four issues out right now. It's worth checking out.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I didn't. I was genuinely curious where the story was going to go when I read the first issue. So I really don't have anything bad to say about it. I just wasn't feeling like it was my thing. But people are liking it. You really like it. So yeah, people, go check it out. It could totally be up your alley.
Yes.
I think that is it for us. Thank you so much for tuning in for another episode.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. As always, if you have any comments, questions, concerns, please contact us via email at heckyacomics@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter, that we are at heckyacomics on there as well. Our Facebook page is the, I don't think it's the, it's just Heck Yeah Comics Podcast. So please head on over there, give it a like, and we'll keep you updated. We are not yet on iTunes, unfortunately, because their approval process takes a while, which is super annoying, and I wish I'd known that. But we will be, hopefully soon. And once we are, I'll be pestering you all to go and give us ratings. You can find me on Twitter at Davluz, DavLuz. Nick is a ghost from ages past
Ghost in the Machine.
and does not exist.
Yep. But maybe he will someday.
Any final thoughts?
Great second show. No. I'm excited for next week. Let's get to next week, guys.
Thanks for that. We're not pod fading yet. As always, if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends. And if you hated it, please tell your enemies. Until next time.
Bye, guys.
What?
worst episode ever.